7. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Good evening to tonight's edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw, and tonight we're going to play a rebroadcast in our first hour of an interview with Terry Hayfield. We're going to focus on the reality of the existence of a permanent revolution, which accounts for the disruptions in our society, political and social disruptions. The second hour, we'll come back to you live with a new edition of the continuing series on the permanent revolution, again with our guest, Terry Hayfield. So sit back and enjoy the show, and long live freedom. Corporate socialism. Our guest is Terry Hayfield. And second hour, we're going to look at communitarian law. There is such a thing as communitarian law. Most of the world knows about it. America is being faced with it. Kelo was an application of the communitarian law. And our guest in an hour will be Nikki Rapana of the Anti-Communitarian League. And that'll be a very intriguing show as well. This hour, though, the show is going to take a look at the macro political economics of our time. Researcher and modern historian Terry Hayfield is going to examine the nature of British American capitalist economics. That's something other than the old-fashioned free enterprise laissez-faire capitalism that most of us who identify as supporters of capitalism would look to. In reality, our economic system is patterned after the British American system of global free trade and an increasing concentration of wealth and an increasing coordination with government. And so Terry's going to look at the desperation of those who are in the capitalist, radical capitalist class, and offer the explanation for how that propels a political state of permanent revolution.
And if Terry says something that you're interested in weighing in on, you can call us at 888-245-4237 if you're out of the area. And if you're local in the Santa Cruz County area, it's 831 or close, 464-8295. And if you want to turn your friends onto the show, you can call them up or send them an email and tell them they can listen to us at f21sc.net/radio.
And but hold those calls for the next 20 minutes or so as Terry lays out the thesis, and then we'll engage in more open conversation. Terry, are you with us?
Oh, I sure am.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. For our listeners, Terry Hayfield has been a guest once before for an hour during our War on Reason series, which you can check out on the archives. And we're going to continue some of the underpinnings that you laid out in that show, Terry.
Okay, basically what I want to do is talk about the permanent revolution in comparison to historical analysis, especially American history. It's my belief that if you have an historical analysis and it doesn't include the reality of the permanent revolution, that analysis is automatically false. Okay?
Well, that's a big statement, so...
That's a big statement, and it hopefully here in about 20 minutes, most of your listeners will understand why I've made that statement.
Okay.
Okay? The permanent revolution is easy to define. It's an existing continuous economic process for the evolution of capitalism into some form of socialism. The difficult part, though, is understanding or comprehending this reality of the permanent revolution is... We as a people have been presented in an official analysis of American history that is very fraudulent.
Hold that thought for a second, Terry. We'll be right
back.
Okay.
Figured it was commercial break.
We're back here while some stations take a commercial break with our guest, Terry Hayfield, okay. And let's just continue, Terry.
Okay. And besides being presented a mutual fraudulent analysis of history, American history, the church and the state... And the press has given us also a distorted analysis of Marx. Karl Marx, the father and creator of the concept of the permanent revolution, is probably the misunderstood individual in history. Regardless of an individual's education or political awareness, the vast majority of Americans actually know very little about Marx and his work. the biggest false assumption made by most Americans is the mistaken belief that Karl Marx was a socialist. Countless books, essays, and movies have been dedicated to praising or condemning Marx as the creator of socialist and communist dogmas that have launched countless revolutions throughout the world and has undermined the very fabric of the American Republic. I know that's a mouthful, okay? But the concept of the permanent revolution, as I said, is easily defined. There was a book published in 1976 entitled Marx for Beginners. It was written by a man named Teofilo Rius, R-I-U-S, who presently is a Ph.D. at UCLA teaching medieval history, and recently he was featured as a authority in a documentary for the International Histories and Science channels called Little Ice Age, Big Chill. And he had to say, he described the permanent revolution thusly in 1976 in his book. As time went on, the merchants and guild artisans grew in numbers and power. They began to shrug off their burdensome yoke imposed upon them by the nobles and the clergy, the first intellectuals of rope, bringing new ideas into daylight. A new class was born, the bourgeoisie. Commerce thus began to change the form of production. The bourgeoisie needed bigger and freer markets to shift their merchandise produced in their shops. Their appetites for profits ran smack against the limits of the feudal mode of production, and these restraints provoked a series of bourgeois revolutions against kings and church, leading to the birth of a new system of production, capitalism. Now, I just want to back up and concentrate on one sentence. The bourgeoisie needed bigger and freer markets to shift the merchandise produced in their workshops. This is the reason for the permanent revolution. That is known as the flaw of capitalism.
Yeah, hang that thought. Our audience is going to come back. Let me catch them up. We'll go from there.
Okay. All righty.
Welcome back to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. I'm Michael Shaw with Roy Avila. Our guest tonight is Terry Hayfield, and Terry is discussing the permanent revolution. And the minutes, if you were gone on commercial break, what Terry has talked about is first he identifies the formulator of the concept of permanent revolution is Karl Marx. But he identifies Marx as a very misunderstood man in the sense that most Americans never really studied him. And so all we have is the little cliches that we run about talking about. What Marx wrote about, and as is described in Marx for Beginners, a 1976 book, is that when the bourgeoisie class began to develop during the feudal times, they needed to create markets for their products beyond their own neighborhoods. And so the clash began, and the capitalist class began to grow, and it began growing bigger and bigger. It overthrew the feudal lords and continued to look for those bigger and bigger markets, which we certainly see today with global free trade agreements. But is that a good enough summary? And if so, continue.
Yes,
if not,
and I will continue.
All right.
Now here's a misconception. Everybody thinks that Karl Marx badmouthed capitalism and demanded the end of capitalism. I'm going to shift to another book entitled Capital is Power, subtitle A Concise Summary of the Marxist Analysis of Capitalism by a gentleman named Jorn K. Brayman in 1984. And if you turn about halfway through his book, he makes the following statements. According to Marx, capitalism has been the most productive and liberating system that humanity has ever known. How many people ever knew that Karl Marx praised capitalism? Its expansionist dynamics, descriptively praised in the first chapter of the Communist Manifesto, and most people have never got past the first paragraph, let alone read the entire first chapter of the Manifesto, have had the most profoundly revolutionary effect on the world. But capitalism is also a system which has its own eventual destruction built into its process. It is the very reason for its success, which will, in the end, promote its downfall. And this is the flaw of capitalism, overproduction under consumption.
Well, now let's pause for a second. Overproduction, under consumption. Help the audience understand the effect of that. You call that the fatal flaw of capitalism. Of course,
right.
You're not the only one. Okay. Many writers have done that.
And I'll continue reading in the book because that'll answer the question.
Okay.
Competition drives capitalists to constantly improve their means of production and thereby to increase their output. The problem is that the market does not grow at the same rate as productivity. Capitalists tend to produce more than they can sell. Eventually, the discrepancy between the capacity to produce and the capacity to consume will be so great that the capitalist system of production and distribution will begin to seriously malfunction. If present history doesn't demonstrate that, I do not know what else will. Throughout the history of capitalism, there have been cyclical crises of overproduction. When consumers can no longer purchase all the goods that are offered, manufacturers cut back on their production, usually laying off part of their workforce. The only saving grace is the invention of new technologies and their corresponding industries, such as railroads, electrification, automobiles, as well as wars, and the subsequent reconstruction of the devastated nations involved have usually served as the stimulants for the rejuvenation of the economy, such as a tsunami aid or Katrina aid, okay? The crisis of overproduction has been with the capitalist nation for many decades now. It has been hidden rather than resolved. It has been hidden by enlarging the market artificially in a number of artificial ways. What Marxists agree on is that capitalism is besieged by the crisis of overproduction, and that so far the crisis has been covered up rather than resolved. And the permanent revolution is that process of looking for a solution to the flaw of capitalism. Now, before we go any farther in this discussion, and I'm going to be done here in about 5-6 more minutes, I have to give a couple of definitions. Capitalism presupposes that only one part of a given population owns the means of production while the greater part does not. If most people owned their own shops, farms, or stores, industrial entrepreneurs would not have the labor force to operate their means of production. Historically, capitalism became possible only when there were sizable masses of dispossessed people who had to sell their labor power to the owners of the means of production to make a living. This is one reason why capitalism was impossible during the early decades of the United States. As land was cheap and available to anyone, people preferred to work for themselves instead of selling their labor power. Only when land became scarce and wave after wave of immigrants tried to make a living did entrepreneurs find the labor pool which they needed.
Well, Terry, I mean, land become scarce. The last time I flew over this country, there's plenty of land, but that's another subject.
That's another subject. All right. If Jefferson's idea of a republic of independent farmers had been realized, capitalism would have been impossible in the United States.
That's because now, there wouldn't have been a pool of labor.
There wouldn't have been a pool of labor, but that did not happen. The first couple of decades of the United States got interrupted with a thing called the constitutional process, and that's another subject. Okay? Now, America, historically, was at that divide, as I just described, of going in industrial or agricultural. In 1776, capitalism did not exist. It evolved after our revolution. Our revolution wasn't fought to install capitalism. It was to install free enterprise. Capitalism and free enterprise are not synonymous. Now, I want to go a little bit farther, and I want to shock your listeners a little bit more. If I was to say to a Republican, the paths of Adam Smith and Karl Marx cross, and they make the same observations and they make the same conclusion, that person would tell me I'm lying. Well, to back up this stuff, and this comes to my third source now on the permanent revolution demonstrating that it is real, using a third independent source, this comes from a 1984 publication called The Second Industrial Divide, Possibilities for Prosperity, written by two gentlemen, Michael J. Piore and Charles F. Sable, a couple of Frenchmen. They were making an analysis of capitalism in the early 1980s, trying to determine what the future of capitalism was going to be. and they make a strange observation on page 22 in their book. And this gets kind of interesting. The core of classical theory of economic development is that increases in productivity, i.e., output per input unit, depend on the increasingly specialized product-specific use of resources. That's a long phrase for machines. According to Adam Smith, the increase in efficiency, however, does have a cost in increased rigidity of the means of production. The more tasks were subdivided and connected in precise sequence, the more difficult it came for the network as a whole to produce anything but what it was designed to produce. Adam Smith, they made those observations somewhere around at the end of the 1790s. A half a century later, Marx integrated this argument about the subdivision of tasks with an argument about the whole role of machines. To Marx, the specialization of manual work, whatever its immediate impact on productivity, was decisively important because it led to the introduction of special-purpose automatic machinery, you know, like a pizza oven. Once a human task has been decomposed into its elementary motions, it becomes possible to build a device that would perform these motions automatically. And, as one step of the manufacturing process was thus mechanized, the preceding and following steps had to be correspondingly reorganized also to keep pace with the new machinery. Thus, the introduction of automatic equipment also increased the rigidity of production, making it harder to switch resources to alternative uses. Now, this is where Marx and Smith come together. They both realized there was, however, a crucial one point. What Marx was describing was every time a new piece of machinery is introduced into the mode of production, you have a new point of overproduction and underconsumption. In 1849, 1850, Marx had no idea how many billions, countless billions, of points of overproduction and underconsumption would come into existence and disappear between 1850 and now. Okay? Now, where Marx and Smith come together. There was, however, a crucial qualification to the idea of a progressive increase in efficiency through product-specific use of resources machines. The dynamic of specialization could be activated only by the growth of demand. Obviously, it made no sense to rearrange the production setup to increase output if there was no market for the increase, and the rearrangement made it expensive to switch the resources to some alternative purposes. In Smith's phrase, the division of labor was therefore limited by the extent of the market. This connection between the market and the division of labor was linked to the second great theme of classical political economy, the transition from agrarian world of a smallholder peasantry paying dues to feudal lords to the industrial world of capitalism. As mentioned before, the United States was presented with that opportunity, and on our first choice of opportunity, we went agrarian versus going commerce and industrial. Specifically, the emergence of Great Britain and the United States as individual powers would eventually become capitalist states. Despite their different perspectives, both Smith and Marx interpreted this transition as the progress from autocracy to specialization. And for both, the moral of the story was that economic interests would reshape political institutions according to the requirements of increasing efficiency. The most that states could do was to construct the process of specialization temporarily. To put it the other way around, freedom. The absence of state interference in the self-organization of economy expedited economic development. And what they're talking about is somewhere down the line there has to be developed a self-regulated classless society.
We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Network. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're going to continue our discussion. So, Terry, you're telling us that as production is increased by improvements in the division of labor, there's always this chase by the demand, and you know that leads to a great flaw in capitalism, how we've seen it repeated again and again.
And they can't get away from it.
Well, but it also hasn't imploded.
No, it hasn't imploded, but they are still working for, and if you hold on to that thought as we progress here, I'm going to touch upon what you're driving at, and it'll come into the conversation naturally.
Okay.
Okay? Because up to this point in time, most people have not heard of the people that I've cited as sources and experts, and I'm going to pull out the heavyweight when we come back from commercial.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes before all of our stations.
2 minutes before that?
Right, so we can talk as it relates.
Okay, there's something I'll share then. What this is going to lead up to, I'll brief the ones during commercial, is that Marx made one other valuable observation that's a real big secret that nobody wants out of the bag. And Marx understood international socialism is totally impossible without the establishment of a unified international capitalism.
Now, that's a big statement. I mean, that's worth repeating.
International socialism is totally impossible without the existence of an international capitalism as the sole means of production.
Well,
only then, at that opportunity, can that international capitalism develop their own self-regulated classless society, which is a prerequisite for socialism.
Well, when you talk about demand chasing productivity, that explains why American jobs are going offshore. It explains why our wealth is being redistributed.
Well, no, not necessarily. The auto industry is what they're leading up to. Besides, the self-regulated class of society is going to operate a means of production that is only going to produce product upon demand. The auto industry right now on an international basis is retooling over and converting to where they will only manufacture autos that are ordered. No longer will you see the big holding lots that you see in regional areas when whatever state you live in. Those are going to disappear.
So is this designed production model designed in order to cure the flaw that you've identified?
Yeah, that's what they're hoping. That's what they're hoping. For example, in the states of Ohio and in Michigan, we've just been announced a rude shock that Ford Motor Company is going to get rid of 30,000 workers real wide, and they're going to shut down some team plants. Well, at the same time, the governors of both states are courting Toyota Manufacturing to build new Toyota plants in the state of Ohio. Now, which way is it here? Either Ohio and Michigan's a bad place to build automobiles, or it's a good place to build automobiles. The answer to the question is, everybody's rearranging to go to a just-in-time delivery basis on a global concern. You're going to walk into a car dealership on Monday, and you're going to order a pinstripe, purple, polka-dotted Ford Torino, and they're going to deliver that to you by Thursday.
Okay, well, we've certainly seen the move to just-in-time inventories for quite a while.
Yeah, most of your foods, most of your fuels that you use are delivered on a just-in-time basis.
Hold that thought, Terry. Right back. Back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio with our guest, Terry Hayfield, explaining to us the nature of the permanent revolution and how that is the cover for really evolving the British-American capitalist economic system into a global corporate socialism. During the intermission there, Terry recited how it was Marx's view that international socialism was not possible without the development of international capitalism. So, Terry, take us on and beyond.
Okay, for proof of this, there's a gentleman that passed away not too long ago named Sir Isaiah Berlin. In the early days of his life, he wrote a book entitled Karl Marx's Life and Environment. This was a most unique book. Isaiah Berlin, in the 20th century, was probably known as the foremost scholar ever to come out of Oxford University. He's known as the father of Oxford political philosophy. He wrote this book, Karl Marx, in his early life, His Life and Environment. It's become known as probably the best biography written about Marx. Okay? It was written in 1939. There's the copy that I have is a third edition. And the third edition is kind of interesting because the third edition was put out by Time Life, but still the sole publishing rights resorted back to Oxford University. But the editors of Time made these remarks in the preface: for most Americans, Karl Marx remains a remote and shadowy figure, even though the shadow has lengthened considerably in the past few decades. Getting Marx into focus has been troublesome for several reasons. And most of those reasons is a lot of lies have been told about him, that he's been was very active and built all these ridiculous lies. The fact is that Marx spent most of his last 34 years of his life reading and writing in the London Public Library. Okay? Now, you go a little bit farther in the preface, you start reading the meat and potato of it. Marx never really completed his analysis of capitalism. On the nature of communist order that would eventually prevail, he was largely silent, and he was vague and inconsistent about the manner in which communism would replace communism, meaning there's never been a socialist or Marxist or communist dogma to overthrow capitalism.
Now, this is Isaiah Berlin writing.
This is Isaiah. No, these are the editors of Time, and they're paraphrasing what Isaiah Berlin was about to tell you in the book.
Okay.
Okay? At some period, okay, Marx was obviously a man of genius. He was just obviously wrong about the direction that capitalist society would take, and I would agree with that. He foresaw neither fascism nor the welfare state. He profoundly underestimated the capacity of democratic societies to correct or mitigate the injustices that seemed to him built into capitalism, and I would agree with that statement also. The concept of class struggle, which is central to the thinking of all Marxists, seems largely irrelevant in America and Western Europe today, and I would agree with that also. Now we get to the interesting statements. But Marx's place in history does not rest in his forecast. His real importance lies in the new modes of thinking that he brought to the political and economic issues. As Professor Berlin states the case, the doctrine which has survived and grown, that's the permanent revolution, and which has had a greater and more lasting influence both on opinion and on action than in any other view put forward in modern times, is his theory of the evolution and structure of capitalist society, permanent revolution, of which he nowhere gave a detailed explanation. Again, Marx didn't have any dogma. This theory, by asserting that the most important question to be asked with regard to any phenomena is concerned to the relationship it bears to the economic structure, which has created new tools of criticism and research whose use has altered the direction and emphasis of the social sciences in our generation. All those whose works rest on social observation are necessarily affected, not only the conflicting classes and their leaders, but historians, sociologists, psychologists, and political scientists and critics and creative artists, so far as they try to analyze the changing quality of the life of their society, owe the form of their ideas in part to the work of Marx. In other words, you cannot look at history and leave out the permanent revolutionary of a false analysis. When you get into the meat and potatoes of Isaiah Berlin's book, he describes Marx's concept of permanent revolution. And this should bring a lot of lights and bells for people, whether you're from the political left or the political right. A party must therefore be formed to function as a political, intellectual, and legislative elite of the people, enjoying its confidence, its superior training, its practical insight to the needs of the immediate situation, able to guide the people's uncertain steps during the first period of its new freedom. This necessary interlude, Marx termed the state of permanent revolution, guided by the revolutionary class dictatorship of the proletariat over the rest as a necessary intermediate step to the abolition of all class distinction.
We'll be right back at Freedom 21 in Santa Cruz in a couple minutes to continue our discussion with Terry Hayfield.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny.
Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic.
To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Do you think you're alone in recognizing that freedom is diminishing in your town and across the nation? Well, you're not alone. And there's plenty you can do to advance freedom. You can help have a major impact on the growing freedom movement by participating in the development of a plan for advancing freedom in the 21st century. The purpose of this document is to create a framework that allows...
This is Michael Shaw again, speaking live from Radio Liberty, here in our pre-recorded interview with Terry Hayfield, waiting for a new live interview coming up at the top of the hour with Terry. Want to remind our listeners to check our website at freedom21santacruz.net. You can get there easily by just putting in f21sc.net. Also, there'll be two radio events this weekend. I will be a guest on Brian Sussman's show on San Francisco radio station KSFO 560 AM at about 7:15 on Friday evening. And Brian will interview me on sustainable development events in the San Francisco Bay Area as well as here in Santa Cruz County. So if you're located in Northern California, don't miss that show. Also, this Saturday on KSCO at 12 noon, that's a Santa Cruz radio station. You can find it on the net at ksco.com. I'll be the host of the Perspective Show. And in that hour, I'm going to interview a local architect, and he's going to talk with the audience about how the Santa Cruz Board of Supervisors has a new plan to take massive amounts of land and in effect, homes here in Santa Cruz County with a new program that is being introduced into our general plan. And also on that hour, I'm going to interview Lorraine Wallace of San Jose, who is initiating a petition drive here in the state of California to change the California Constitution. In short, she's proposing that no eminent domain can be used in this state for private gain. So once again, we're seeing the fallout from the Kelo decision as people all over the country, both liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, band together to stop the abuse by government of our inalienable right to the use and enjoyment of our property. So don't miss either one of those shows. That's Friday night at about 7:15 on KSFO 560 AM and Saturday at noon on KSCO 12 noon. That's at 1080 AM. Here in Santa Cruz. And we'll be back live at the top of the hour for a new interview with Terry Hayfield, continuing the discussion that you're listening to tonight on Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. And until then, continue to enjoy this show. Thank you.
Almost every citizen in your town. Many have noticed and are ready to act to advance individual liberty, family autonomy, a vibrant ecology, and a strong economy. They're doing this by turning their individual initiative into local action for national impact. To find out how you can join others to advance freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. That's freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. Be sure to stay tuned at the top of the hour for our next show, which will center on the issues raised in this last commercial, how communitarian law has invaded our local and national legislatures, much to the disadvantage of every individual in America. But now let's return to our discussion with Terry Hayfield and discussion regarding the permanent revolution and how British American capitalism has us on a bandwagon that has long been understood by those few people. And when we finish with this, Terry, we'll open up the phones, and those who've got some questions can throw them at you. But
I just have a couple closing comments.
Okay.
There's only one organization that has been in existence that has had majority control of the direction of the permanent revolution and determining the ideologies necessary to implement the economic process of the evolution of capitalism and socialism. That organization is the Fabian Society that's based in England. The Fabian Society over the last 100 years has operated and forged a growing unified American-British capitalism. And their sole goal is trying to establish a global unified capitalism based on Fabian Socialist precepts, or Fabian Society precepts. The present economic policies carried out by the United States government right now are directly related to the permanent revolution. They come directly from Leon Trotsky, who inherited furthering the permanent revolution from Marx. And Isaiah Berlin recognizes that in his book, Karl Marx's Life and Environment. The ideology of a group of people known as the neoconservatives is based squarely on the existence of the permanent revolution. The neoconservatives got their foothold inside the White House with the election of Ronald Reagan as president. Those same neoconservatives that helped nurture the Reagan Revolution are the same neoconservatives that are nurturing the international war on terrorism. They are removing the last vestiges or impediments to the establishment of, or the final establishment of, American-British capitalism. One-third of the world, Islam, lays outside of American-British capitalism.
Okay, well, that certainly lays fertile ground for a further discussion of a...
One other thing.
Go ahead.
The major economist that the neocons use is a gentleman named Joseph A. Schumpeter, who wrote a major book in 1942 entitled Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. He's mimicking the basic observation of Marx of capitalism, socialism, and communism as being integral parts of the same process. Schumpeter recognizes that capitalism can survive. It doesn't have to kill itself off if it gets control of the process known as creative destruction, and in the process utilize creative destruction to allow capitalism to establish a self-regulating classless society. I'm done.
Okay. let me jump in here.
Go ahead, Roy.
Obviously, Terry. If I would have just happened on this radio program and heard you speak for the last half hour, and I didn't know anything really about Marx or wasn't as well researched, I might think that if we would have just followed Marx's ideas in the purest sense, without all the twists and turns, that we'd be in good shape.
No, Marx never had an idea of what to do with capitalism. All Marx ever did was look at what was bad about capitalism. He recognized it up until that point in time in history, it was the most efficient form of production man has ever known. It was still rotten to the core because of the unequal distribution of the wealth.
And the other thing that I wanted is, you talked early on about free enterprise versus capitalism. For people who aren't as well read, explain what that is.
Okay. Prior to the American Revolution of 1776, specifically probably the last 20-25 years prior to the revolution, 90% of American economic activity took place outside of the British mercantilism system, the early vestiges of capitalism in England. The colonials were on the raw end of the stick on mercantilism. The host country, England, was taking all our natural resources from us and turning them into manufactured goods that was they tried to sell back to us at twice the value of the natural resource that we shipped to them. And the colonials wouldn't purchase. Okay, and the colonials actively avoided paying taxes to the crown and avoided buying manufactured goods from England. They operated through what was known as privateers that operated a system called the Golden Triangle. excess agricultural production from our farms was sold to these privateers that took the grain down to the Bahamas and had that turned into rum, and then they would take the finished rum and take that to France and sell it to France as English rum, and made a killing because English rum was embargoed in France for obvious reasons, and then they would take their cash and go over to England where all the warehouses and the shipping docks were filled up with these unsold goods, buy them at a song and dance, and then bring them back to colonials and sell them outside the mercantile system. That's how the colonials recognized economic activity could take place outside of a church, outside of the control of a king, outside of the control of a feudal lord.
Genuine
they saw it as free enterprise. Capitalism didn't exist then. So when the revolution started, one of the first things the colonials did was form a Continental Congress, and the Continental Congress formed a commission to draw up an official document to operate as the constitution for the newly formed republic, for the new 13 independently created states. Okay? And their economic activity was basically private enterprise, free enterprise. People owning their own farms, their own shops, loving the idea of making their own money, not having to make a payoff to a priest, not having to make a payoff to a government official, not having to make a payoff to a tax collector, etc. Even though things may not have been absolutely terrific, they were better off than anybody else that was living under feudalism that was still existing at that time in Europe and in England. They liked that idea. Now the problem here, this is where the rub comes in. Yes, the American Revolution is one of those revolutions, one of those bourgeois revolutions that Marx observed that took place. And yes, it was run by the bourgeoisie. But the bourgeoisie lost control of the revolution after the fighting was done and England capitulated. Because everybody liked the idea of making their own money and keeping it for themselves. As a matter of fact, the Article of Confederation that was set up by the Continental Congress was, in a way, a dictatorship for the proletariat. The Perpetual Union made sure that nothing was going to prevent the sovereignty of those people from deriving the pleasures from their private property. The rich people, the people that ran the revolution, couldn't get their hands on the production value, future values of the land from the colonies, because the central government was powerless. They had no way to run greed and graft and corruption. So they conjured up this constitutional convention and saying the Article of Confederation are wrong. And they got the colonials to trade off their freedom and the protection of their free enterprise for a new constitutional government that was more or less dedicated to create a more perfect union. And it's been kind of like downhill ever since. Had the Constitution never been ratified, we probably wouldn't be having this radio program about American-British capitalism, because there would have only been British capitalism. American capitalism would have never developed.
Okay, before we take a call, I've got a question. You made reference in the same paragraph to Fabian socialists and neocons as both working actively. Fabian's in control of the permanent revolution, that is, the protection of the interests of radical capitalists by way of transforming the heretofore capitalist system into a global corporate socialist system, if I understand.
Now, they got to have global capitalism before you get corporate socialism.
Okay, well, we're certainly well underway with that process. And
yeah, and that's the reason why we have the International War on Terrorism right now, because one-third of the world is not playing by rules of the American-British capitalism as dictated by the Fabian Society.
Well, now, definite statement of a revolution and one of a permanent nature, at least as described by the Bush administration.
Yeah, see, most Americans don't understand. Tony Blair was a longtime chairman of the Fabian Society.
Well, that sort of deals with the person who says Fabian socialism died away in the 50s or 60s.
Yeah. See, that's another thing. Most people listening to this probably have never heard of the Fabian Society, and that's because there was an active push started in the 1960s to obliterate Fabian involvement in American history and present involvement. And they've been very successful at it. Now, for most people that don't know, all you have to do is type in www.FabianSociety.org, and you'll get their website.
Well, and to the listeners who want to see how the Fabians operated from their inception in the 1880s in England,
through to and including control of U.S. administrations here in the earlier part of the 20th century. We have multiple copies of the incredibly valuable book called Fabian Freeway, written in 1966 by Rose Martin. And if you want a copy of that book, go to our website, Commerce Section, or call us at 831-684-2232.
Well, I'm glad he brought that up, because this is really important. In that book, Rose L. Martin dispels all arguments. There exists in this country an organization known as the Council on Foreign Relations. Scumpeen different people from the left and right have all had their own ways and versions of stories of how the Council on Foreign Relations came into existence. And the only person that's got it correct is Rose L. Martin. The Fabian Society created the Council on Foreign Relations, not David Rockefeller, not the Bilderbergers, not the Illuminatis, not the Freemasons, not the Zionists, not the Communitarianisms, the Fabians. Well, the Fabians are masters at creating front groups. For example, you've got a lot of listeners right now that are dedicated Republicans. How many of those Republicans know that the Republican Party is a member of an international organization dedicated to establishing global capitalism? It's called the International Democrat Union. And for those of you with laptops, www.idu.org, and you're there, and you'll find that the Republican Party is a member party of the International Democrat Union.
And I would venture to say, Terry, that anyone in the audience who identifies themselves as a Republican because they believe in American sovereignty and unalienable rights and the ideals of America will no longer vote Republican after they've looked at that site for maybe half an hour.
Yeah. Then, conversely, for all you Democrats, the Democrats have an organization called the Democratic Leadership Committee.
Of which Bill Clinton was quite infamous.
Right. Okay, the Democratic Leadership Committee is a sub-member organization of an organization called the Third Way, founded by, oh yeah, Tony Blair. The International Democrat Union and the Democrat Leadership Committee, or Council, or whatever it is, are both Fabian creations. We have a one-party system in this country.
Two divisions of the Fabian Sustainable Party, at least that's how they like to make it look. Sustainability sounds also sweet. But sustainability and sustainable development is the process of affecting the transformation through this concept of permanent revolution. It draws on a lot of things, like the war on terror, but the economic dynamic, the social dynamic, is driven through this process called sustainable development.
Yeah. Sustainable development, though, is you got to remember, is just one cog in many, many wheels.
Sure, but it's what you see when you're at home. It's what happens to your children when you send them off to a government
school. Most Americans don't realize that they've already been Sovietized.
Well, you made mention of that in the last show, and
and those are called natural work groups, self-directed work teams, employee involvement programs. Those are nothing more than Soviets that sprang up in what was to become Soviet Russia between the abdication of the Tsar in March 1917 and the onset of the October surprise in 1917. During that period of time, most of your civil order in your major Russian cities were conducted by the Bolsheviks in what was known as Soviet Workers' Councils. Very similar to how the United States of America operated prior to the Constitution being ratified in this country. We had hundreds of microeconomic systems that were in economic balance. Supply equaled demand. And it just kept expanding, staying in balance. That got interrupted with the passage of the Constitution. And it gave the commerce people and the bourgeoisie a foothold in the door to get their hands on the productive future of American wealth.
Yes. Now, we have Roger from on line one. Roger, are you with us?
Yes. Thank you, gentlemen. Yeah, I'd like to... I think it's very important to remember that virtually all the big-name neocons in their own writings on record as being anathema beyond the pale of thought to roll back any of the Great Deal, Great Society, or New Deal socialisms. And this is what the slop that passes for conservatism, of course.
Well, you can't expect one arm of Fabians to cut off the other arm.
Fabians.
Yeah, and also I had kind of like, well, what's better is two questions rolled into one. It drives me nuts almost every time I heard the word capitalism used, other than in a quotation, because I think the word is unnecessarily vague, nebulous, insusceptible of a definition. And
there's a great little simple definition for capitalism.
Here's what I was getting at. Since any of all possible economic systems are both capitalist, that is, relying on the means of production, and are also market economies, then the only question is if they are free market or controlled market economies, with all the range of various possibilities in between.
But we don't have a free market economy.
Yeah, we know that, but I'm just saying, if we stick to those self-regimentation and use of terms like that, then it becomes a lot clearer, I think, whether we're having freedom or control.
Yeah. Most people, nine out of ten people who's going to be listening to this program all recognize that there is something wrong in this republic, that there is a threat to the future existence of this republic, and they're looking for just exactly what that threat is. My take on it is, it's not an ideology like communism or socialism or neoconservatism. The real enemy is an economic process, and that economic process is capitalism. There's some
as defined, we might say, in the last show, Terry, you told me to go look at a Webster's Dictionary definition. I did. I don't have it with me tonight. But capitalism is defined by Webster's as an economic system that starts out freely competitive but ends up a system where wealth is concentrated and partnerships are made with government. And, of course, that is what's happening today. It gets right to Roger's point. The issue is controlled or free markets. But capitalism, by its Webster's Dictionary definition, and by the way it's been played out by British free traders combined with their Eastern established American partners, has turned to be exactly how Webster's defines capitalism, and that is not a free market. That is not a market-driven economy. It is a central control-driven economy that lends its way to this global corporate dynamic that becomes a socialist corporate dynamic.
Yeah, when you take a look at the laws that have been established, especially in the last 50 years, those are laws that make sure that capitalism stays the sole means of production for society. It does not allow for newcomers to challenge for the existing monies that are in circulation. For example, the dot-com phenomena during the 1990s. The dot-coms sprang up with the Internet. These people found out that you could get people to give you money over the Internet in exchange for goods or services at a much quicker speed than anything than existing organizations that were represented on the stock market by the blue chips. And it exploded. And the blue chips got together and came up with a scheme to drive the dot-coms out of business, secure that technology for themselves, and stop the drain for the challenge and competition for dollars. And that was during the last part of the 1990s when the blue chippers talked the dot-coms to go public instead of staying private. And they got themselves to overextend. People were millionaires one day, next day they were broke.
Well, the notion of how difficult it is for newcomers to break in is certainly evidenced here in California and probably around most of the country. If you had enough capital to buy some land to build some houses on it, try to get some permits if you're not part of the old system. You simply cannot do it. So it is this increasing centralization and control of our economy.
Yeah, I look at it, there's two kinds of private property. There's corporate private property and what they don't own yet.
Well, that seems to be how our next topic, communitarian law, services that need. You know, communitarian law puts the rest of that private property in the hands of the community, which ultimately becomes part of this corporate.
I would like to be part of that discussion because I've avoided the most difficult part of this discussion of overproduction and underconsumption, and it comes down to what is value. and you get into the discussion of Marx's concept of surplus value. What is surplus value? The American colonials knew exactly what surplus value was. They were wallowing in it because they didn't have to share it with anybody. Today, people don't have a hoot and a holler what surplus value is.
Well, there's a couple of things that I want to jump in on here. One is, you know, you talked about corporate owning all of the land, so I'm guessing we can define in that folks like the Nature Conservancy and the World Wildlife Fund who are also buying up all the land that they can get their hands on.
Yeah, they're doing it in the United States of America. They're doing it through the United States government, the White House controlled by the Fabians. And the Congress and Senate is greatly influenced by the Fabians. Yeah.
And then the second Fabian program was, you know, we talked about free market but being a good thing, but we're also being sold free market as CAFTA and NAFTA and all these other things.
That's not free NAFTA because they use the term free to sucker everybody in. There's nothing free about it. If you do not trade by what's prescribed in those rules and regulations, you can't trade. That's not free trade. I can't, like, for example, I know a bunch of unfortunate people that were downsized from the auto industry that are design people. And we've all sat around drinking beer discussing that, oh yeah, we could start our own car company, we could put out a decent car for $15,000 per request from the consumer, but we would never be able to go into business because we would never be able to max all the laws to make sure that the capitalists don't have competition. We couldn't meet all the, we couldn't afford to provide the test trace cars. We couldn't afford to do the, you know, meet all the environmental regulations just to build the factories as a private entity. The laws are stacked against you from any kind of competition in that thing.
Well, Terry, we've got about a minute left, and I want to share with the audience the notion that Freedom 21, what we're planning to do is embark on a series on how to counter the permanent revolution. And we're going to spend some more time before we get to that point talking about how it is that the permanent revolution is the tool being used to save the economic interests of the truly radical, high-grade capitalist class who is calling the shots and who is accumulating the assets and the resources of America and Americans.
Yeah. Let me barge in. We'll make it real clear.
Real quick, because the time's
okay.
About out.
It's impossible for President Bush to, one, fight a world war on terrorism to protect the future existence of the American Republic, and at the same time take part in NAFTA, CAFTA, World Trade Organization, General Agreements and Tariffs and Trade for American security, because those things demand the end of American sovereignty. You can't have it both ways.
Well, and we're moving there very quickly, and those who want to hear more on that subject, go to the archives and look at Steve Yates' discussion of free trade and the bogus free trade agreements that Terry Heafy is talking about. Well, Terry, I want to thank you
very much, Terry.
All your years of work and for your concise explanation of some very complicated topics here today. And we'll look forward to continuing this discussion in the future. And for our listeners, stay tuned for the next hour of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. We'll be right back.
views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Good evening. This is Michael Shaw, the host for tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and I'm sitting here with my co-host, Roy Avila.
Happy anniversary, Michael.
Well, this is the two-year anniversary of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and every week has been fun. And we hope you've enjoyed our shows, and we hope you enjoyed the last hour's presentation, a rebroadcast from January of this year. We're going to continue the discussion of the permanent revolution with guest Terry Hayfield, and expand upon what was discussed in this last hour. But let me summarize a bit of the conclusions that I think can be drawn from that hour's show. Number one, capitalism, and we're talking about state capitalism here, we're talking about fiat capitalism, the funny money system that America exists on today. Capitalism, socialism, and communism are an integral parts of the same economic process. And our guest Terry Hayfield describes that process as the political reality called the permanent revolution. And I think if we sit and look around our society or pick up tomorrow's newspaper, we'll see evidence of a revolution, you know, revolution, war, terror happening everywhere. Well, perhaps this is the design of that process. Number two, I think Terry demonstrated that the true enemy of the American Republic is that economic process. It's not an ideology. It's an economic process that is causing some of the woes, the major woes that we're feeling today. That process is run by a radical capitalist class, in the sense that this class is radical because it needs to destroy the concept of national sovereignty in order for the class to continue to exist. Now, that's an interesting prospect. We certainly see evidence of how America's sovereignty through a permanent revolution, we might say, is being eroded from all ends, whether it's our borders or our trade policies or our culture itself. Number four, the demonstration that the permanent revolution is bourgeois in nature and not the result of a Marxist dogma. And I think we're going to have some callers coming in shortly on that subject. Number three, Terry demonstrated that it is impossible to do a basic study of Marx and not know the reality of the permanent revolution, because it was Karl Marx who first coined the concept. And, of course, what we've seen is the Fabian Society picking that up sometime after Marx's writings and carrying it forward through to today. And number two, Terry described the flaw of capitalism, which is the reason for the permanent revolution. You know, today the flaw of capitalism is covered by this process called sustainable development. Whether it's the left liberals who become the pawns of public-private partnerships, or the neocons themselves, those guys who are behind the public-private partnership, the radical capitalist class itself, we see that revolution happening in the form of all kinds of change agencies that are just dominating from our children's classrooms to our local planning departments to our federal government's foreign policies and trade policies, etc. And finally, Terry contends and makes a strong argument that any historical analysis just isn't accurate unless it includes the reality of the permanent revolution. So with that as a background into tonight's discussion, we're going to proceed in the next hour to talk about how knowledge and courage can save liberty, because Terry Hayfield is going to explain the reality of the Fabian direction of a permanent revolution designed to dismantle the American Republic. So we're going to be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz with our guest Terry Hayfield. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and We're going to continue our discussion of the permanent revolution. In this interview, Terry's going to address how cognitive dissonance promotes the permanent revolution and why it will require revolutionary courage to defeat the threat that faces us all. So, Terry, how are you this evening?
Oh, very well, thank you.
And we just replayed the January broadcast on the permanent revolution, and I think we're ready to expand with more information about how it operates and what its effects are, and what we need as people to begin to do to recognize and take action against a permanent revolution designed to take us all down.
Okay. My concept of the permanent revolution is an easy concept to define, and that's the continual process of capitalism trying to evolve into some form of socialism. Well, a lot of people would brand that as a conspiracy theory, even go as far as brand it a paranoid conspiracy theory. Okay? When I try to explain the concept of permanent revolution to any individual, and it doesn't matter their level of education, I always run into a very big roadblock that I have, a very big problem in getting over, and that's called cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is a condition where an individual will accept two opposing concepts at the same time, which causes an internal conflict. For example, right now, most Americans, especially Republicans, demonstrate a state of cognitive dissonance. The Republicans want to back a war of terrorism to protect future American sovereignty and security, and at the same time, these same Republicans are promoting supporting an international free trade system that requires explicit surrender of national sovereignty if that free trade system is ever to work successfully in the future. That's cognitive dissonance, holding two separate ideas at the same time. It can't work. You can't have it both ways. Okay? Well, we all understand as a people that there's something wrong behind the scenes. There's a great enemy or a great force that threatens the future existence of the Republic. And in the last show we said that's capitalism. That comes under the genre of being a conspiracy theory, and I can understand people wanting to brand that a conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories have abounded, especially during the 20th century, going into the 21st century. Great time. Okay.
I'm sorry about that. Let me. Our audience has returned. Let me summarize what's happened while some stations have broken away for commercial. Terry is discussing cognitive dissonance, which he defines as holding two opposing ideas at the same time. I mean, boy, you know, to do that is to put you in one big state of disequilibrium. And that, though, promotes the idea in the minds of many people that the consistency of ideas somehow reflects a paranoid conspiratorial mind when you begin to relate these conflicting ideas into a unified thought. And his example of cognitive dissonance, say with some Republicans, neoconservative Republicans in particular, is that we're protecting America by conducting a war on terror while we engage in free trade that destroys the sovereignty of national decision-making when it comes to trade policy. So we're really holding two positions at the same time. One is to protect American sovereignty, the other is to destroy it. Inconsistent positions that are reflective of cognitive dissonance. And when that's pointed out and a reconciling notion is suggested, the idea that Terry suggests that reconciles these different notions is that what we're doing is that we're engaging in the permanent revolution, which is really designed upon society in order to promote within each of us these kinds of conflicting notions within our own being. And if I've summarized that properly, Terry, continue. And if I haven't, correct me, please.
Well, you've hit it squarely on the head. Now, since most Americans understand there is some sort of threat to the future existence of the Republic, they then become susceptible to alternative interpretations of the news than what we see in the mainstream. This comes under the genre known as conspiracy theories. And as I said prior to the break, conspiracy theories have been growing during the 20th century and into the 21st century. And a man named Daniel Pipes, P-I-P-E-S, wrote a book in 1997 called Conspiracy, How the Paranoid Style Flourishes and Where It Comes From. In this book, especially between pages 21 through pages 33, he gives some basic definitions for the terms conspiracy, which is a description of a real criminal activity, versus conspiracy theory, a non-reality thing that doesn't exist. Okay? And through these pages, he describes how all conspiracy theories have their roots in either one of two sources, anti-Freemason conspiracy theories or anti-Semitic or anti-Zionist conspiracy theories. He identifies, though, there is one other genre of conspiracy theory which he considers the mainstream conspiracy theorist that want to shun the tag of being anti-Freemason or anti-Semitic. And he calls these people conspiracy theorists, and they believe in a world conspiracy theory based on the existence of an organization called the Council on Foreign Relations. By the time you get to page 30 of Mr. Peep's books, he goes into describing how conspiracy theories and fantasies convince people. And he correctly recognizes most conspiracy theories have just enough truth or facts to make them sound plausible. Now, the biggest thing that Daniel Peep recognized in conspiracy theory lore is when you have an expert or somebody that's considered an expert endorses a conspiracy theory. And he cites an example on page 1933, which is probably the most famous example of an expert recognizing a conspiracy theory, and that is a man named Carroll Quigley. He wrote a book in 1966 entitled Tragedy and Hope. And at the time, Carroll Quigley was one of America's leading scholars in history and the development of political science on a global basis. And he, in 1966, in his book Tragedy and Hope, describes a network that he said was a real conspiracy that really existed, and he does this on page 950 of the book Tragedy and Hope. Now, this page 950 of Tragedy and Hope has become the, quote, John 3:16, unquote, of what is known as the Saving the Republic community in this nation, that they agree with Carroll Quigley that what Quigley describes in page 950 is an actual organization that exists. Now, in Mr. Peep's book, Mr. Peep cites, or appears to cite, the entire first paragraph of page 950 of Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. But he doesn't. He leaves out one important sentence. And it is a most unique sentence. It's a simple declarative sentence. And it says, this myth, like all fables, does in fact have a modicum of truth.
Now, what fable is being referred to here? I think the listeners need to understand.
Quigley is identifying a data set, a historical data set, that he's going to eliminate from his analysis of history. He calls it a myth, like all fables. He doesn't use the term conspiracy theory, of which that was a term in use in those days, in 1966, but he avoids using the term. He uses the term myth and fables. This myth, like all fables, this one particular myth, like all conspiracy theories, does have a modicum of truth. Now, what's really unique, if you turn back to page 949 of Tragedy and Hope, Quigley does describe, in fact, that myth, that fairy tale.
What he calls a myth or a fairy tale.
What he calls a myth and fairy tale. This radical version of these events, which is now an accepted folk myth in many regions and American groups, picture the recent history of the United States in regard to domestic reform and informed affairs as a well-organized plot by extreme left-wing elements operating from the White House itself and controlling all chief avenues of publicity in the United States to destroy the American way of life based on private enterprise, laissez-faire, and isolationism in behalf of alien ideologies of Russian socialism and British cosmopolitanism. This plot, if we are to believe the myth, worked through such avenues of publicity as the New York Times, the Herald Tribune, the Christian Science Monitor, the Washington Post, the Atlantic Monthly, and Harper's Magazine, and had at its core the wild-eyed and bushy-haired theocrats of Socialist Harvard and the London School of Economics. In that last sentence,
this is Quigley writing, describing what he characterized later as a myth.
As a myth.
As being the condition that many in the early 60s believed to be the case.
Yeah, for example, in 1960, John F. Kennedy was elected president. Okay? John F. Kennedy at that time was the epitome of being a representative of what was known as the East Coast establishment, the liberal East Coast establishment.
As is John Bush today.
As is George Bush today. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, John Bush, I'll take that. That's pretty good. Clever. I like that.
I didn't mean that, but the point's
okay.
made.
Okay, he came out. That's a good phrase. Anywho, Eisenhower made a very major speech just before he left office warning about the military-industrial complex supported by the liberal East Coast establishment. That was the source of a whole bunch of new conspiracy theories. For example, in 1962, a man named Dan Smoot put out a book called The Invisible Government. In 1962, it went through, that I know of, five printings, because the copy that I have is a fifth printing. So in 1962, the book had enough popularity to be sold in six printings. He talks about the Fabian Society only in a reference in supporting his thesis. Just one sentence. In 1964, a man named John A. Stanley wrote a book called None Dare Call It Treason. And in that year, and the book that I have is a 20th printing of 1964, over 1 million copies of that book was published in 1964 alone. It was the fifth largest ever single-selling paperback in history up to that point in time. But instead of briefly mentioning the Fabians in passing, John Stormer devotes many, many pages of his books describing the Fabian Society. By 1966, Roselle Martin's book comes out, The Fabian Freeway, which is totally 100% dedicated to describing the Fabian Society as running the White House, having control of the electoral process, control of all avenues of public publicity, not only that, control of our major educational front through our educational system and our colleges. Something had to be done.
Let me interrupt for a second. The Rose Martin book is truly a spectacular book, and it's out of print, very difficult to get a hold of, but we do have copies at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, so you can go to our commerce section, or you can contact us, and if you want a copy of Rose Martin's 1966 book that Terry's talking about, called Fabian Freeway, contact Freedom 21 Santa Cruz.
It'll change the entire way you look at history, especially American history, after you read even the first 50 pages. Okay? Anyways, what was demonstrating was this growing myth, this folk fairy tale, that was becoming the mainstay of the American right, radical right wing. Now, this scared the bejesus out of the Fabians. In 1964, there was a man named Barry Goldwater who basically overthrew the international control of the Republican Party and stole a convention and got himself nominated to be president. Well, all the people that were followers of Barry Goldwater all had read The Invisible Government and had read None Dare Call It Treason. And they understood the Fabians were the people that were running the White House. In the book Tragedy and Hope, on pages 1247 through 1249, Mr. Quigley goes on to describe how the Goldwater campaign almost upset what the secret people behind the scenes were doing. It's their biggest fear is being exposed, and that they're real. So Tragedy and Hope was written to eliminate the Fabians from American history. Because once you discover the Fabians' involvement in American history, you're only one step, maybe two steps away from discovering the permanent revolution. And then you understand that what is passing for domestic and foreign policy out of the White House is not for the preservation of the American Republic, it's for the destruction of the American Republic.
Wow. Let's hold for a second here. We have a caller from Georgia, Ted, who has a question from the last hour's show dealing with Marxist thought. Ted?
Yes.
Give us your question, please.
Yes, mine is far more narrow than what the gentleman's talking about at this point. He said in the last hour something in regard to Marx finding that that capitalism was a prerequisite to socialism, something of that sort.
Correct.
I had this experience. I'm an old codger. And over 50 years ago, when I was a freshman in college, I was in the fraternity house, and one of the upperclassmen, he was a sophomore, so he was an upperclassman. We were discussing, perhaps he brought the subject up, he was taking economics, or political science, I suppose it was. And he said the big struggle of our day was between socialism and capitalism. This does relate to Marx, incidentally. And I said, well, I was fresh out of high school, and I said, what is socialism? And he gave me a definition that it was state control, perhaps of the capital goods of the nation. And I said, well, what is capitalism? He said, well, that's private. That's private capital controlling the capital goods of the country. The distribution of capital goods. And he went on to say that these were two entirely different ways of determining the needs of the people. And in my ignorance, I wanted to determine my own needs, and so I rejected both of them. I said, I don't think either one of those is valid.
That happened in 1776, what you did.
No, what I
it is not that old, Terry.
Yeah.
what I'm talking about is 1948. I was a freshman in 1948.
Okay, what Terry's suggesting is that the colonists came to the same conclusion that you came to in 1948. Is that?
Yeah. That's what I was intimating.
What is that?
48.
The colonists.
Basically, the decision he made in 1948 is the same basic decisions most of the colonists were coming to in 1776.
Okay, you're right. When you said 76, I didn't know because I wrote about this in 1976.
Uh-oh.
many years went by, and I finally grappled with the thing, encountered it again in my thought, and determined that I accepted that he said that I was wrong because he'd had the course.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I accepted the fact that if he'd had the course and if that was what the course was saying, what the course told him, then obviously I was wrong. But then along about 1975 or 76, I had some second thoughts on the subject, and I said, I believe I was right in the first place.
Yes, you were.
And but the point I want to make is that in reference to your having said what you did about socialism and capitalism being a requisite for socialism, and according to Marx, I have determined that the basic structure behind communism and socialism is one and the same.
Yes, and that's capitalism.
Well, you can, you know, I call it socialism, but
socialism is a prerequisite for communism. You see, in socialism, what happens in socialism, there's a final implementation of a self-regulating class of society, and all classes cease to exist.
Perhaps you're right on that, but let me go ahead with what I was saying, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
The same structure, the main point is that the same structure underlies both socialism and capitalism. And you can call it capitalism, and I can call it socialism, but the structure is going to be the same either way.
Exactly.
Now, you have an elite at the top, and you have the masses beneath that, and you do not have interference from the middle class.
No.
And that's the reason Marx wanted to eliminate the middle class.
And Marx only surmised the middle class would dissolve on its own, but go on, he didn't.
What did you say? Excuse me?
Marx assumed that the middle class would dissolve on its own.
Yeah, well, it was still a matter of... It was not a part of the structure, that's my point.
Yeah, right. The middle class would disappear with the expansion of capitalism, which... In the United States of America, we're watching our middle class disappear. In 1964, the many people that backed Barry Goldwater in the Republican Party were bourgeois people that recognized that their middle class life was disappearing.
Yeah, well, let me give you something else to dispute. In a friend of
mine. Well, no, I've been in agreement with you all the way. Keep on.
I understand. What you're saying, now let's get back to our difference. We agree on the structure. The only thing you call it capitalism, and I call it socialism, and I don't think it makes any difference. What we call it, the structure is going to be the same.
Correct. Not going to argue with you.
But what we're running into now, which is more or less proving your point of calling it capitalism, is the idea that government is being privatized.
Correct. They're bringing government into being a business of its own.
In the lingo of sustainable development, it's called public-private partnership.
Yes. Yeah. And for example, in Iraq right now, most George Bush goes out in the political stuff telling you how free enterprise and capitalism is starting to flourish in Iraq. Well, I'm a student and devotee of watching C-SPAN. I watch it at all hours of the day. And I watch this neat little report to kindly inform me there are no privately owned companies in Iraq. Everything is licensed through the government of Iraq and or some non-governmental organization in Iraq, and that's usually Halliburton. So there is no resurrection of free enterprise. We're seeing the gamut of public-private partnership to the max, what it's going to be at the nth degree. If you take a look at what we're trying to institute in Iraq, and the Iraqi people don't seem to like the idea of what we're trying to implement, well, the American people, if they understood that's the same things being implemented on them, I don't think they would like it either. But it's the same process.
Well, the process is for the government to go underground. Now, there are certain functions, and I'm digressing a bit, and there are certain functions that I consider to be government functions. I think we could both agree on the fact that there are certain functions that normally governments, at least normally as far as our traditional thought is concerned...
Laid out very well in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution.
Constitution, correct.
Well, let's not get bound down at this point with any particular authority. Let's just say that they're government functions. And those functions can be performed either privately or they can be performed by the government. For example, the prison system or even the Federal Reserve. That's a private organization performing a government function. We can agree on that.
Yeah, but are you aware that the Federal Reserve is not an independent entity, though, even though it's privately owned? It's a member bank of a larger organization called the Bank of International Settlements.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Okay, good.
But the fact is that the point I'm making is that the present plan is for the government to go underground. And when the government goes underground, that means that all these normally government functions will be performed privately. And when they're performed privately, then they're performed behind the curtain, behind the corporate veil, so to speak.
Yes.
And therefore, there's no disclosure as to how they operate.
Correct.
And that's the whole objective of the present privatization program.
Exactly right.
And it's not really a privatization program. so to speak, in what most, what the common man in the street would consider a privatization program.
Go on and explain that, what you're saying. Why is that?
Most people, when they think of a business or a corporation, they think generally it's made up of well-meaning American people that still believe in the red, white, and blue, and that what comes out of their mouth is really pretty close to being reality and true. And when they start talking about, we want to privatize government, we want to privatize the healthcare program, blah, 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 what they're doing is, we're getting ready to throw up a big wall.
Getting ready to what?
They're getting ready to throw up a big wall.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
And behind this big wall, if we think there's graft and corruption now in the healthcare industry, think what it will be 20 years down the road. Now, you were a college freshman in 1948. I wasn't born until 1948. Okay? So my growing up experience is totally different than your growing up experience. But I can remember people used to get fairly decent health care, state-of-the-art at the time, at a reasonable price. Now, in the last 40 years, mankind has gone in and has improved on health care. That's a quote, improved, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Have they? They built a lot of architectural wonders, but have they given us the same amount of health care that we got in the 1940s and the 1950s for the same value in exchange? Heaven's sakes, no.
Mm-hmm. That's the biggest problem that we're faced with. Or at least it's a very big problem. It's not the biggest. It's right in there with the biggest. Is the fact that they're at the point now. They've messed everything up, and now they want to sweep it under the private rug.
Oh yes, that's the hook. But when they use terms such as private property, their concept of private property and our concept of private property are two different things.
Exactly. This is one of the things that's been gnawing at my.
When George Bush uses the term freedom, I'm quite sure his definition and concept of freedom is totally different than what the common man in the street has.
Yes, we need to have superscripts on words like freedom and democracy.
In the same token that we should have a standardized definition. In just basic Marxist terminology of what capitalism, socialism, and communism is. Because
Right. Once
you understand the basic definitions of those words, you can sit down and read your newspaper and go, oh, now I know what he was talking about. Okay?
It's interesting that one of the things that I've noticed several years ago, I heard an establishment person, probably on TV, make reference to democratic control. And democratic control to the ordinary American means control from the bottom up. Common people control the hierarchy. To the elitist, democratic control means the method used for the elite to control the populace.
Well, sure. Well, Gorbachev says the more democracy, the more socialism. And that's certainly the case.
Now, I'm glad you brought up the concept of democracy, because at one time, this nation did function as a democratic nation. We were under the aegis of what was known as the Articles of Confederation. Now, tonight, Michael and his co-host said that this was an anniversary for you guys, and that anniversary is what, 2 years on the air?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right.
Okay, well, sir, you're older than I am. Can I ask you, do you know what anniversary this is today for the American Republic?
What anniversary it is today?
What took place in history?
In 1806?
No, not 1806. 1777, March 1st.
I think you're probably talking about the Articles of Confederation, right?
Ratification of the Articles of Confederation. When we were under the Articles of Confederation, this nation operated as a true democracy. We exchanged our democracy for a republic in 1786.
this is the Articles of Confederation. Now, the word confederation means against federalism, against centralization.
No, actually, at the time, and if you go to Blatt's Law Dictionary, a confederation is a organization or a unification of states with the similar ideas, but accepting a common cause.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily mutually exclusive of what I just said.
Yeah, I understand.
It's a definition, but I don't think it contradicts what I said.
No.
I think that the Confederates, both at the time in 1777 and later, those who were Confederates were opposed to federalism.
Okay, in that sense, yes, sir.
Huh?
Correct.
And those,
I agree.
Those who espouse federalism espouse centralization of power in the state, in the federal government.
Correct.
And that's the reason during the Civil War they spoke of the Federals.
Yep, Federals versus Confederacy.
Right.
And the Civil War was fought over the same issue that we're having the War on Terrorism, and that's over the issue of free trade.
Right, I can understand that. That's a little bit, I've not thought much about that, but that's probably true.
Oh yeah, it is. When you get in, once you get past the popular propaganda.
And may I ask you? I tuned in late. Tuned in early, and then I went about some chores and came back in. May I ask who I'm speaking with?
Terry Hayfield.
Terry Hayfield, right? Well, good time.
Spell with a Y. Terry, spell with a Y.
I see. Well, that's fine. I certainly enjoyed talking with you.
If you're interested in more of what I have to say, if you have a computer and you're online, just type my name, Terry Hayfield, into anybody's search engine, and you'll get quite a few
of my answers. H-A-Y-F-I-E-L-D?
Yes, sir.
Fine. Thank you. And it's Terry or Jerry?
Terry.
Terry, I see. Fine. Thank you. I'll do that.
Well, thank you for calling.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, call anytime, Ted. That was marvelous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ted.
Bye.
Well, Terry?
Yes, I agree.
Uh-huh. It's uplifting to hear American people calling in and knowing such things as this is the anniversary date of the adoption of the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah, that surprised me.
And the reasoning that Ted displayed, and you know, and it's the basis of this kind of knowledge that's going to bring about the kinds of it's your term, revolutionary courage, that's going to bring America through this battle called the permanent revolution, whether we see it in our newspaper as the attack on our children or the war on terror or whatever other war is being designed by the federal government, whether it's on poverty or on drugs or on terror or on whatever other manufactured dialectic dynamic that they think of next.
Obesity is the current one.
Well, that's
there you go.
There comes another one. Well, we do have another caller. Let's take Roger from Pennsylvania. Roger?
Yes, thanks, folks. I was thinking earlier these people that are, you know, upset about people developing conspiracy yarns. I expect they're more upset that Carol Quigley said I had the opportunity to look at the papers, etc., and so he kind of spilled the beans more than they are about that the Rubik conspiracy theories spun up around his bare naked statement. It's interesting that we have perhaps now 1,000 or more books purporting to document conspiracy in tedious detail with all those footnotes and whatnot from primary source. Yet we never hear about the one or two non-existent books that purport to debunk these same conspiracies. They attack around the edges or pick on some real or imagined anti-Semitism, etc., without going after the central core arguments, yes?
Correct. Now, on Quigley... Yeah, Quigley's selling point in Tragedy and Hope was, I got to see their secret papers. Because all of us know there has to be somebody's secret papers out there somewhere, if there is a conspiracy. Now, when Quigley wrote Tragedy and Hope, he wanted to put to rest a popular conspiracy theory, as I mentioned earlier in this hour. Okay? So he brands 50% of American history of the 20th century as a myth, as a fairy tale. And the sad part is today we have many well-meaning patriots that their basic position, when you track it all the way back, as you say, through the tedious footnotes at the bottom of the page, all come back to page 950 of Tragedy and Hope. Well, when Quigley's talking about he got to see their papers, yes, he got to see the actual papers of the roundtable groups. The roundtable groups, when they were initially set up at the turn of the 20th century in England and the United States, were reading clubs. The Nickelodeon hadn't really invented yet. Movie theaters didn't exist, and of course radio and television didn't exist. So people's cultural entertainment were reading clubs. And on the East Coast, the most popular reading clubs were the roundtable groups that were basically started by American Fabians. It was a great opportunity for the Fabians to use the format of the roundtable to permeate Fabian ideas through. It was a natural setup. The Fabians opposed the roundtable group's point of view, which came from the concepts of a man named Cecil Rhodes. Cecil Rhodes set up the roundtable group, supposedly, was to bestow upon white English-speaking peoples of the world to reunite underneath the English crown again, which meant eventually bringing the United States back into the crown. Whereas the Fabian says, why waste with just reorganizing the British Empire when we can reorganize the whole world? But the roundtable groups would be a great place to start through and permeate through and sell our idea. As a matter of fact, a Fabian by the name of William T. Steed set up the roundtable groups for Cecil Rhodes. And most people don't understand that. Carol Quigley totally ignores that fact. He does recognize the existence of William T. Steed, but fails to recognize Steed as a Fabian. Because on page 949, Quigley says the Fabian Society and anything associated with that is a fairy tale. And he had to sell that idea big time. Because people were starting to really associate the Fabian Society with control of Washington, D.C.
And that's the real secret to the message you deliver, is that as the permanent revolution established through political operatives going back into the 19th century began to unveil itself and implement itself through the direction of the Fabian Society, having spread out throughout the world, that when, as Americans began to familiarize themselves with this reality in the early 1960s, it became necessary to squash that whole idea, and no better way to do it than to call it a fairy tale,
yeah,
and to take it out of print.
Let me jump in here.
Another thing is, conspiracy need not be illegal per se to be immoral just the same. Any more, like the surprise birthday party would be an example of a conspiracy that's not immoral either. But, I've been reading, I picked up at the library, not that it's worth any much, but this book by an author named John Lukacs, who I've never heard of, the title was...
Yes, I'm familiar with him.
Democracy and Populism, subtitle Fear and Hatred. And then you see this simplistic reductionism, since he thinks that democracy, there's nothing great wrong with it, but populism, he would be correct that it has unlovely aspects, but the reductionism is that conspiracy per se is a populist interpretation that somewhat exclusively, and therefore it's on the face of it, unworthy of consideration.
Well, I'm familiar with this. I've read the book.
So it would make a great little semantical study in rather slick and subtle obfuscation.
Oh, it is.
By misidentification.
That's exactly what the book was written for. The same reason Tragedy and Hope was written for. Tragedy and Hope was written to dissuade people away from discovering the Fabian Society. For example, I have an associate that, prior to his going entry into the Vietnam War in 1970, he was working at a major Midwestern university as an assistant librarian. Okay, he goes to Vietnam, comes back from Vietnam, and he notices when he comes back from Vietnam at that college library that every reference to the Fabian Society had been removed from the library over a year and a half period. completely disappeared. And that included writings by people such as Arthur Schlesinger and Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who were mainstays in one of our major Midwestern universities, which brought this really kind of to a dynamic situation. But a whole data set of the Fabians were moved from a major college library. Quite amazing.
Yeah, if the previous hour was fresh on your mind yet, it's like I heard it again through fresh ears, and I just do I take it to imply that you think there might actually be validity to the theory that it is possible to have overproduction of goods without a market? That is, that this results in some sort of crisis which must be redressed, and also that you think there may be a validity to a problem of unequal distribution of wealth, both of which I so far reject.
Okay, there's another term for the term unequal distribution of wealth. That term is inflation. When you get a chance, have some fun, pick up a variety of dictionaries and look at the definitions for inflation and inflationary. They get quite interested.
Well, I don't
okay, and I, the reason I'm bringing this in is I talk a lot about the flaw of capitalism, that it cannot overcome its problem of overproduction and underconsumption. Inflation is a gauge for overproduction and underconsumption.
Well, I don't believe that because somebody's worth $1 billion that necessarily reduces my standard of living.
Well, yeah, I know. It's the same corollary. You got people who say, oh, I don't know why people complain about the poor today, because the poor today is so much better off than what they were 100 years ago. The poor today has air conditioning, TVs, and at least they get to drive a beater car, and they've got some sort of minimum wage income, so and they get to eat so they're not dying, and the state takes care of them, gives their inoculation. Now, they're so much better off today than what they were 100 years ago. And they call that progress. And they're not any better off today than what they were 100 years ago. Misery is misery. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that still want to wave the red, white, and blue for capitalism in this country. Those people are the ones that still have a job and they're eating and they're still able to make their payments on their loans. But as soon as they get removed from the capitalist system, either they're going to be downsized or they're going to become unemployed. One way or another, they're going to become a victim down the road. And if the last 100 years business cycles are any indication, we're long overdue for a 1929 situation where inflation just rampantly gets out of their control, and a lot of people will change their political opinions and their ideology when they can't pay the bills, the house gets repossessed, and they're hungry and there's no job available.
Well,
I work in a pizza shop right now. Okay, and I live in the Midwest. I live about 40 miles south of Toledo. And we have 5 pizza delivery guys. I'm an unemployed semiconductor engineer. I have 2 unemployed systems analyst people. I have 3 unemployed programmers, and we're delivering pizzas.
Yeah, well, I think the problem with billionaires is not their wealth so much as what they do with the money, having acquired it. And I still don't, it's going to be a hard sell with me how the fact of having billionaires impoverishes me per se. In fact, I think certain of their economic activities, even if they don't intend it, may enhance my standard of living. Granted that other things they do with their money may be deadly dangerous and work against that standard of living.
Well, right now those people are running a deadly dangerous game with this international war on terrorism, because if they fail dreadfully, and I mean if they continue to upset the rest of the world may get very unhappy with the existence of one superpower, to the point that they might become just as upset as a world as the world did in 1945 in handing
Germany. They'll take it out on average Joe American and not the billionaires.
There it is. And that's what's coming down the road.
I think a cornerstone of Terry's thesis is that as the capitalist financial system begins to wear at the edges you have a situation that's increasingly understood by the general public, and certainly known by the radical capitalist class. And so the question is for them: how do they transition a monetary system that is not faring well and is designed to not last forever? How do they maintain control when there's an implosion of that financial system? And that's what the permanent revolution is designed to do. And of course, the police state that's emerging all around us is a mechanism by which they can maintain control even if the financial system does not
to jump in here. Whenever the permanent when the expansion of American British capitalism falls into crisis, that's when they have a tendency to submit to some form of fascism and remain in control of the direction of the permanent revolution. Fascism is only just a symptom of the breakdown of overproduction and underconsumption.
Well, thank you for your call, Roger. Well, Terry, we've got 7 or so minutes left here in the show, and bring us to some conclusion for how it is that the message that you have needs to be carried away with.
Presently, right now, as I stated earlier in the show, we have a lot of well-meaning patriot Americans that write books, run radio programs, some of them run TV shows. They sell monthly newsletters that are telling Americans there's something wrong in Washington, D.C. And the message that they're giving their people comes from page 950 of Tragedy and Hope. It ignores the Fabian Society. It ignores the permanent revolution. For 40 years, this genre of people have been trying to sell the same story, and they haven't changed the direction of the permanent revolution. They haven't even slowed up the permanent revolution, let alone they haven't even exposed the permanent revolution. They have to knuckle down and recognize that what was on page 950 is fraudulent. The real story is on page 949. You've got to rediscover the Fabian Society. You've got to discover the permanent revolution. You've got to understand your well-meaning efforts the last 40 years. You've got to take a long look at it and say, it hasn't produced anything. Why hasn't it? And this is why. You've been going down the blind alley, and you've been taking a lot of people with you.
Wow.
I've approached hundreds of these people over the last 20, 25 years, and it's very difficult to approach them and say, hey, I want you to scrap your entire career and accept a new point of view, but at least take a look at what I'm saying. There's a lot of validity to it, and if you're really serious about wanting to save the Republic, you might really want to include the permanent revolution in your analysis, because if you can't identify the enemy correctly, you can't plan for a successful future. And right now, we're identifying the wrong enemy. We're identifying ideologies and people. We're not identifying the process, and that's capitalism, and that's the real enemy.
And when you say capitalism, for the people who've come in more recently to this conversation, we're talking about state capitalism. That is the process of increasingly eliminating competition, concentrating wealth, and partnering with government. And next week, our regular listeners are certainly not going to want to miss our interview with Dr. Steve Yates. The subject will be public-private partnerships, the dynamic that's happening in every town, in every state, and at the federal level. It is swallowing up America in a way that Mussolini never dreamed of. So,
absolutely, hear, hear.
The issue of capitalism, as you're referencing it here, is the funny money, fiat money system that operates in partnership between a very select elite and governmental officers who receive their monies, who pass their laws, and who make it more and more difficult for free enterprise to survive in this country. The real battle, if we're going to look at it at the economic level, is between capitalism and free enterprisers. And as we see the capitalist machinery just squeeze out industry by industry the operating free enterprises in this country, we begin to see how it is that this global capitalism with their free trade policies is leading us to a world, not a national, a world socialist corporate system. And I think one of the areas you didn't get to today is the self-directed work teams that we've discussed with you on prior shows. But when we end up with a loss of our national sovereignty and global corporations in control who have established that self-directed work team, we are then living in a communist state, in a communist world. And that was the dream by Marx. And you made a comment earlier about how Marx said that the middle class would self-destruct. And I saw a remarkable thing on television last night. Here in Santa Cruz, there's been an ongoing discussion of what's called the Creekside Ordinance. The Creekside Ordinance takes the city of Santa Cruz and takes every drainage ditch, calls it a creekside, and says that anything you do in your yard has to be 100 feet away from this drainage.
Now, if you've been watching C-SPAN, they've been discussing tributary runoff, creek runoff, river runoff. It's a big issue right now in D.C.
It's a huge issue. It's my company is encountering it in a number of cities right now. They're all coming this way. But the self-destruction of the middle class was evidenced to me last night when about 50 homeowners got up to the city council and told them what a wonderful job they had done of writing an ordinance that takes, sometimes the so-called creek is in a pipe under the ground, and now you got a big setback from that pipe because you're not allowed to discharge anything into it. So the city is grabbing people's backyards right from under their nose. The city residents go and applaud the city council for doing that, so much so that one of the city council ladies, a bread baker in the city, congratulated the audience by this statement. She said, "Oh, this has been wonderful. It shows the power of the group mind." I sure wish that Erica Carl or Charlotte Iserbite were here right now, because that's that's the whole idea behind this new takeover that is just swarming our communities. And while we're out there working hard and raising our children, this is what's happening between the consensus-based government and government.
Those people will change their tune when the developers come in and want to build a hotel and casino complex in their neighborhood, and the neighborhood gets condemned.
Well, and that's one of the things that will be discussed on the KSCO show this Saturday, with the discussion being eminent domain from a woman in the city of San Jose, where one-third of the housing stock has been declared blighted, paving the way for that kind of eminent domain action. And, of course, that's a national issue that everybody can get involved in in one way or another, because most every state has a reaction to this kind of public-private partnership, capitalism out of control dynamic.
And if people think we're talking crazy about American British capitalism, the same thing that's going on with the assault of private property in the United States, you have the same issue taking place in England. Tony Blair's government has condemned over a million Victorian era homes as being blighted.
As not being sustainable.
And not being sustainable.
Yeah, that's his words, not mine.
Yeah.
Well, Terry, we'll continue this discussion, because it's not an easy concept for people to really glob onto and be able to pick up their newspaper and understand how it is being rammed down our throats here in the United States. So thank you once again. And
thank you for the opportunity.
We look forward to the next time.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
And for our regular listeners, go to Stewards of the Range, www.stewards.us, and look at the petition for calling for the repeal of the Endangered Species Act. Action is being taken. Lots of support is being shown for their effort. And take action. As Roy always says, do something. And we look forward to it. Hearing
or nothing will happen. We'll be stuck.
That's right. We'll be back here next week on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and we look forward to your listening audience and an expanding listening audience. Have a good week. Long live freedom.